Good evening. With just 6 days to go until tens of millions of Americans exercise their democratic right to vote, President Biden has just issued a warning about the fate of democracy itself. We'll get Senator Bernie Sanders' take on it shortly. First, the president, just before airtime, he began by talking about the attack on Paul Pelosi, the alleged plot to kidnap, interrogate, and maim House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. He quickly framed the issue as the shared and urgent need to fight for the survival of the American experiment.
Appeal to all Americans, regardless of party, to meet this moment of national and generational importance. We must vote, knowing what's at stake and not just the policy of the moment, but institutions that have held us together as we sought a more perfect union are also at stake. The extreme MAGA element of the Republican Party, which is a minority of that party, as I said earlier, but is this driving force, is trying to succeed where they failed in 2020, to suppress the right of voters and subvert the electoral system itself. That means denying your right to vote and deciding whether your vote even counts. Instead of waiting until an election is over, they're starting well before it. They're starting now. They've emboldened violence and intimidation of voters and election officials. It's estimated that there are more than 300 election deniers on the ballot all across America this year. We can't ignore the impact this is having on our country. So I ask you to think long and hard about the moment we're in. In a typical year, we're often not faced with questions of whether the vote we cast will preserve democracy or put us at risk. But this year we are. This year, I hope you'll make the future of our democracy an important part of your decision to vote and how you vote. I hope you'll ask a simple question of each candidate you might vote for. Will that person accept the legitimate will of the American people, of the people voting in his district or her district? Will that person accept the outcome of the election, win or lose? The answer to that question is vital. And in my opinion, it should be decisive.
Oh, whatever you make of the substance of what the president said, the context is unavoidable. These are the final days of a deeply consequential campaign for control of both chambers of Congress. Nearly 28 million people have already voted. The big name surrogates are on the trail or are about to enter the fray. And new CNN polling shows what likely voters say is important to them. By a wide margin, it is the economy. Second, abortion, and third, voting rights and election integrity, which the president touched on tonight. Joining us now, CNN This Morning co-anchor Caitlin Collins, who until recently was our chief White House correspondent. Obviously, it's a critical moment for the president. Obviously, voting's already begun. Does this move the needle in any way?
I think that's a big question. I'm not sure the White House necessarily expects it to, but they felt like it was important for him to give this speech. And it's a speech he had been wanting to give for some time. And when people ask why, President Biden isn't often a mystery. You don't really have to read between the lines when it comes to him, because he really does truly believe what he said tonight, that this is important, that it isn't an inflection point. And look at what he's been doing lately, carrying around John Meacham's new book on Abraham Lincoln and talking about how he dealt with his own reckoning. John Meacham helped with the speech tonight. He helped with the similar speech that President Biden gave a few weeks ago in Philadelphia. And so I think he really, truly does mean this when he thinks that the nation is at this inflection point. He's deeply disturbed by, obviously, the Pelosi attack, and that contextualizes why he is speaking of that tonight, why he opened with that tonight. If you're the more cynical political person looking at this and you ask the question, is that the right closing message this close to the midterms? Is that really what you want to be your last parting words to voters before they go to the polls as their early voting? Because, yes, if you look at polls, people do care about the health of the democracy. It does register, but it pales in comparison to inflation, to the economy. And so look at what those Democrats who are in vulnerable positions have been saying in the last few days on the campaign trail. It doesn't look like the speech tonight, but the White House still felt like it was an important speech for President Biden.
I mean, look at the numbers that we're putting up right now. Economy, inflation, 51%. The next is abortion at 15%. That's extraordinary focus, obviously. Yeah, huge gap. It's also hard to see that this speech will be seen through any other lens than a political lens this close to an election.
Which is interesting, given, of course, all of the back and forth when he gave his Philadelphia speech, which was a White House event. And the White House said it was not a political speech to talk about the health of democracy, to call out the MAGA Republicans that he's been referencing. This was an explicitly political speech tonight, this close to the midterms, a DNC event. One thing he did say tonight that I want to remind people about is when he talked about what to keep in mind when they go to the poll.
I hope you'll ask a simple question of each candidate you might vote for. Will that person accept the legitimate will of the American people, of the people voting in his district or her district? Will that person accept the outcome of the election, win or lose? The answer to that question is vital. And in my opinion, it should be decisive.
That's a big question. If whether or not that is going to be the last thing people are thinking about. You know, that CNN poll today said only 50% of people believe elections actually reflect the will of the people. Of course, whether or not that's what they're closing their vote on. He did prepare people for there are going to be candidates, he believes, that do not accept the results of the outcome next week as legitimate. And that is something he was essentially arguing that you should brace for.
Yeah. Caitlin Collins, appreciate it. Thank you very much. Caitlin's new program has just launched, CNN This Morning. Starts at 6 a.m. Eastern time, so be sure to make it part of your morning. I hope you get some sleep tonight. Thanks for staying up with us. Joining us now is Vermont Independent Senator and former Democratic presidential candidate Bernie Sanders. Senator Sanders, appreciate you joining us. You heard President Biden say democracy is on the ballot. Americans can't take democracy for granted any longer. Is he right?
Yes, he is. Look, when you have a former president who went around saying that the only way he could lose an election is if there was fraud, think about what an outrageous statement that is. You know, I've run in many elections. Sometimes I've won. Sometimes I've lost. People can lose elections. And clearly what Trump and the extreme right wing are trying to do now is undermine faith in American democracy. So the president is absolutely right. This is a major, major issue. People fought. I don't have to explain this to anybody. People fought and died against Hitler, against authoritarian governments in order to make sure that in this country, it is the people who determine the future of our nation.
51.
And that you have people right now who are trying to undermine American democracy is really outrageous.
We're showing that poll, 51% of voters put the economy, inflation as the number one issue. Do you think the president's speech is going to change any minds ahead of this election?
Well, I mean, I hope it makes people understand how consequential this election is, because this election is about the future of American democracy. It's about whether or not women can control their own bodies. It's about whether we deal with the existential threat of climate change, which threatens the well-being of our kids and future generations. But of course, Anderson, it is about the economy as well. Right now, what we are seeing is some 60% of our people are living paycheck to paycheck. They are struggling to get by, while the billionaire class has never, ever, ever had it so good. More wealth and income inequality today than any time in American history. And when we talk about inflation, you know, what everybody should know is that the profits of the oil industry are record-breaking. Huge profits for ExxonMobil, the other companies. The food industry, people can't afford to buy the groceries they need. Food industry profits are soaring. Airline industry profits are soaring. So what has happened is that in the midst of the war in Ukraine, the breakdown in supply chains, which are important parts of why inflation is high all over the world, Republicans forget to tell the American people, inflation is not just an American issue. 8.2% here, that's bad. It's worse in Europe, over 11%. So yes, the economy is very, very important. And we cannot do as the Republicans wanted, give massive tax breaks to the rich, cut Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. That is not a solution to the economic problems.
Whether it's fair or not, though, as you know, Democrats are getting the blame, or at least this White House is, for inflation, for the economic numbers. New CNN polling shows Republicans gaining momentum. At this point, is there anything that can be done to turn that around? I know you are out there. You are in the midst of an eight-state campaign swing focused on the economic message. Is it too little,
Anderson,
too late?
Let me answer you in this way. You know, what Republicans are saying is it's Democratic spending that caused inflation. That's just not true. Again, in Europe, in Germany, England, throughout Europe, inflation is higher. It is a global problem. But let me say this. Republicans say that it's Democratic spending, and what they really mean by that is it was the American Rescue Plan. And I want everybody watching to go back to March 2021 when the American Rescue Plan was passed. At that moment, 3,000 Americans were dying from COVID every single day in the midst of the worst pandemic we have had in 100 years. At that moment, unemployment was soaring. Small businesses were going bankrupt. Hospitals were unable to continue because of so many people coming in for COVID. Yes, we passed the American Rescue Plan. That's $1,400 for every man, woman, and child, which saved many families. We put money into hospitals so that they continue to go. We extended unemployment. We did a $300 tax credit for parents. So I have no apologies for doing what I could, along with the rest of the Democrats, to try to save the economy and help working families.
I do want to ask you about the attack on Paul Pelosi. The president spoke about that tonight. Do you see any of that vitriol, danger to lawmakers, their families? Is that ever going away? I mean, will there ever be a certain level of kind of decency restored, or is it past the point of no return?
No, let's hope that it can return. You know, there is too much ugly rhetoric out there right now. And this authoritarianism and this attacks on democracy often lead to violent type rhetoric. And I would hope that we can calm that down. People can disagree without being disagreeable and certainly without talking about violence.
Yeah. Senator Sanders, I appreciate your time tonight. Thank you. We go next to Arizona, where former President Obama is campaigning tonight. CNN's Kyung Lah is in Phoenix for us. Former President Obama, Kyung, has been crisscrossing the country in the final days of the election. Is he still seen as an effective messenger for Democrats in Arizona?
Well, if you talk to people here in this line, the line that just has disappeared behind me, it was wrapped all the way around for a block and a half or so and snaking through this parking lot. These people will say he is absolutely the effective messenger, if nothing else, to try to inspire the base to turn out. People here, the Democrats in Arizona, know what they need are the numbers. They need the turnout. So they think that Obama hitting all of the battleground states is a good sign when it comes to control of Congress. The question will be is, will it really carry through enough to sort of blunt any Republican energy? What Democrats will tell you, at least here in Arizona, is that they might not be exactly voting for Democrats on the ballot. I didn't really talk to anybody here who said that they were incredibly inspired by Katie Hobbs, who is running for governor. But they are terrified of the Republicans. This is a Trump-backed ticket. The people on the ticket are election deniers. And we've seen, these vigilantes show up at ballot boxes with guns. And the people at this Obama rally, the ones who are lined up, many who I spoke with, say that they simply do not feel that that is the fabric of this state.
Mm. Appreciate it. In Phoenix tonight. Thank you. Next, our Shimon Prokipes, continuing his months-long investigation into the mass shooting at Robb Elementary. He has new details tonight. And another new devastating phone call from a student trapped in a classroom that's never been released, never been heard before. And later, as members of the Pelosi family are shown video of the attack on Paul Pelosi, we learn the Capitol Police had a video feed that actually showed the break-in in San Francisco, but no one was watching it in real time. A viewer warning now, the next report contains some very difficult audio, so if you have young kids in the room, you might ask them to leave. CNN has obtained more never-before-released 911 calls from some of the children inside Robb Elementary School in Uvalde, Texas, during the massacre there. You should also know that it is the parents of the kids in this report who want this made public. For months now, in addition to everything else they've had to bear, they've been misled over and over again about what happened, which is why they want this audio played and this story told, because if not for this and other reporting, largely by CNN's Shimon Prokipes and his team, they simply would not be getting answers, period. That's what so many of the parents have been saying to us. It is in that spirit, mindful of how difficult some of this new audio is to hear, that we bring you the latest tonight. Shimon Prokopez joins us now. So what is this?
So this is it's the same phone call where a second student, a second child, gets on the phone. A little girl by the name of Mia Cirillo, she gets on the phone. Our report last night was with Chloe Torres. Chloe hands her the phone at some point. And so Mia then takes the call and is talking to the 911 operator. And this just shows, again, the continued lack of response, the lack of any kind of sort of way that police forced their way into the room, the fact that they took their time. Another significant thing that happens on this audio is that there are gunshots. We do not air those gunshots out of respect for the family. But again, it all paints a picture of law enforcement that did not respond appropriately, that failed, as officials there in Texas said. And again, this is something that the families have asked for us to play and to come forward with because they need answers. And they say this will help, hopefully, bring transparency. Take a listen.
Hello?
I'm here.
Okay. Is the killer in the building?
I'm sorry?
Yes,
he's still there in the building, so I need you to be quiet and do not open the door until I reach you.
Okay.
Everyone, be quiet as possible. Stay quiet. Make sure everyone stays quiet. Are there officers here? Okay, hold on. Don't do anything. What was that?
I think the officers are in the building.
Okay, officers are in the building, but not open the door until I tell you.
Okay.
Okay, just stay quiet.
And Anderson, you see there, what we did is we put it side by side with as she's talking to the 911 operator, you see those officers in the hallway. What's so striking was that when there were gunshots in the classroom, you start to see the officers advance towards the classroom. You see them there going on their body cam footage, but yet it took nearly 30 minutes still before they went into the classroom.
And that little girl is in, this was a double classroom, that is in the same area with the shooter.
She's in the same area. The shooter at this point, it appears, is in the other room. He's in the same classroom. There's a door that divides the classroom. That's open. It's room 111 and 112. He appears to be in the other room. At one point, you can hear her. She was uncertain if he was even in the room. She thought maybe he somehow was outside of the room.
And as we heard in the phone call last night, which is part of the same phone call, there are dead people.
There are.
Children in the room.
And what we don't show, because it's just so, it's too difficult to air, and is you, at some point, you stop hearing noises in the background. You stop hearing people, the kids, teachers.
People who had been wounded.
People who had been wounded, who were screaming for help. At some point, you no longer hear them. And really, all you hear are these two little girls. And the other people in the classroom are just sort of, it goes silent. Some of them can hear the noises outside the classroom. They could tell that there are police outside the classroom. They can hear the helicopter. They know there's activity going on. They just don't understand what's taking so long, and they don't realize that the officers are just feet from the door. But again, even after those gunshots are fired, even after the officers knew that these kids were inside the classroom alive, trapped with this gunman, with the gunshots being fired, it still took almost 30 minutes.
It's sickening to the courage of 10-year-old children, fourth graders, to call 911 and be on the phone with a 911 operator narrating what is happening and officers being feet away and not entering the classroom, which is the training. And officers outside, at least many of them, knowing that there were children alive, calling 911. I mean, there was confusion, but there was the knowledge that these kids had called.
People in positions of power, people who should have been making the decisions, they knew. And that's the key in all of this.
Shimon Prokopis, thank you. Joining us now, the father of that brave girl you just heard, Miguel Cirillo. Miguel, I appreciate you being with us. When you first heard that audio of your brave daughter doing this, what did you think?
I just broke down. I broke down, heartbroken. I had a lot of emotions running in me. I didn't know what to think. I didn't know what to think. I didn't know what to say. I was speechless. I couldn't say nothing. I was just mad. I was mad because now I know why my daughter was so mad. And I'm very proud of my daughter. She did what she had to do to survive. But it took them a very long time just to get not only my daughter out, but the rest of the survivors out of that classroom for 77 minutes. I mean, it takes too long. It's too long. I mean, if my daughter and Chloe had the courage to take the phone away from the teacher to call 911 to let them know that they're still alive and they need help, why not one officer jump and said, hey, we need to go in there? They still waited outside for a very long time to get any kids or to break the door down or anything. They took too long. I believe that students, even one of the teachers that was shot, that my daughter was telling me, she would have still been alive. A lot of these kids would have still been alive if these officers would have reached that door as soon as they would have heard that phone call.
Did you say that Chloe?
If they would have heard that call.
Did you say that Chloe and your daughter? Did you say that Chloe and your daughter got the phone from one of the teachers?
Yes.
One of the teachers who was shot and killed?
Yes. Yes. Between my daughter and Chloe, they brainstormed and they got the phone and they called 911. My daughter told Chloe to call 911.
They had the presence of mind. This is the first time learning this. They had the presence of mind to take a phone from a teacher who had been killed. They had the courage to do that and to call 911.
Yes, sir. They had the courage to do it, but the officers didn't have the courage to go in and protect innocent kids.
You must be so proud of her.
I'm very proud of her. I'm speechless. I'm very proud of her. I tell her all the time I love her and everything. I mean, we were inseparable until now. You know, now we can be around each other. But I guess since a boy did this to her, she's real angry against every man right now, I guess. I'm not sure. But lately we've been getting closer and closer and closer. And I love that our bond is getting back together where it was. And she's trusting me even more.
She's been changed by this experience. This is not something that she's just... You know, people think, oh, well, kids can bounce back. This is something you see the impact on her still.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Every day is a different day with her. Every day we got to wake up and we got to see how she's doing, see how she slept through the night, because there's night that she doesn't sleep. She won't sleep for 2-3 days still. There was several days that she wouldn't sleep and we had to stay up with her. And me and my wife had to switch spots and be like, hey, you know, you sleep for a few hours, you stay up with her and we'll switch and we'll keep switching.
Did you ever expect, I mean, when this happened, the horror of that day, did you ever think that we would be here all these months later, still waiting for answers, still waiting for an actual minute by minute account and accountability?
I thought it would have been way faster to put accountability on somebody, but it's taking way too long.
Miguel Cirillo, I appreciate you talking to us tonight and thank you. And I just wish your daughter and your family the best.
Thank you.
Coming up, we'll have the latest on the investigation to the attack on House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's husband and the security cameras that were on but not being recorded. Or excuse me, I should say, not being monitored in real time. Plus the comment on the attack by Carrie Lake, the Republican candidate for governor in Arizona, that she says was the product of, quote, creative editing. We're keeping them honest on that next. As we mentioned earlier, President Biden began his remarks tonight about the threats to democracy by drawing a line from the attack on House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's husband back to the January 6 rioters chanting, "Where's Nancy?" A short time ago, we received this new video of Speaker Pelosi leaving her home in San Francisco and security presence now surrounding her. Earlier today, members of the Pelosi family gathered with police to hear the 911 call and watch body camera footage of the attack on Paul Pelosi. Now, this comes the same day that the Capitol Police confirmed reporting by CNN and The Washington Post that they had cameras on the Pelosi residence, which caught the break-in and the police response, but the cameras were not actively monitored at the time of the attack. In other words, no one was actually watching them in real time. A source tells CNN it wasn't until about 10 minutes after the incident when an officer noticed the lights and sirens in the video. Today, congressional Democrats now demanding answers from the Capitol Police about security for members of Congress. Court documents filed Tuesday say that the suspect, David DePape, allegedly told officers and medics at the scene that he was on a, quote, suicide mission. Joined now by CNN Chief Law Enforcement and Intelligence Analyst John Miller. First of all, the surveillance system of Capitol Police, no one actually watching it. Does that surprise you?
Not in the slightest bit. It's actually kind of a dumb question if people are thinking, like, there's 1,800 cameras feeding into a command center in Washington, D.C. There aren't 1,800 officers each watching one of those monitors. Mm. What they're doing is they're listening to the police radio, they're watching for incidents, they're zeroing in on cameras where something's happening. They are much more attentive to the camera that's on the residence where Nancy Pelosi is actually staying in Washington that night than a place that's 3,000 miles away where their protectee is not present. So it's unreasonable to think that they would have been staring at that.
And that's literally what it is. I mean, 1,800,
And I mean, you don't see all 1,800 monitors. You see lots of monitors where, you know, there's five people in that command center who are doing numbers of jobs. And if there's something in a camera where they say, pull up that camera, let's see what's going on there. The simple fact that they saw police cars and lights on one of the cameras and said, which camera is that? Let's go to that. Let's figure out what's going on, shows that they are paying attention. Mm-hmm. But the NYPD and LMSI, we had 20,000 cameras. We couldn't watch 20,000 cameras. We were monitoring events and using the cameras to zero in on them.
The Washington Post also reported that Speaker Pelosi's round-the-clock security, including a San Francisco police cruiser, that used to sit outside her house after January 6th, that was no longer there. I don't understand why there wouldn't be a burglary system, or I was just surprised there wouldn't be even one officer on the scene at that house.
Well, she wasn't there, and this may change.
So government protection is for the quote-unquote package, not for the spouse of the package.
If you're in the White House, it's the president, the vice president, and their families. If you're in Congress, it's the protectee. You got to remember, the Capitol Police is 2,000 cops who cover 2.4 square miles of Washington, D.C. It sounds like a lot, but when you figure the enormity of the Capitol complex, not just the building, all the other buildings, the checkpoints, the intelligence people, the bomb squad, the SWAT team, divide that across three shifts. It's not that big a department. And if 535 members of Congress had a security detail, they'd have to add 3,600 people, even if you kept those details small. So a lot of that is triage. But to date, if they're going to look at people who are in the line of succession for president, they have security details. Leadership, they have security details. Family, that's a question that they're going to have to go into because of this incident. Yeah. But it's never been that way before.
John Miller, appreciate it. Thanks so much. On Monday night on the program, we played a video from a campaign event earlier in the day for Carrie Lake, the Republican candidate for governor in Arizona. Specifically, it was her response to a question about school security. During that response, she mentioned the attack on Nancy Pelosi's husband, Paul. I want to play that exact same piece of sound again, and we'll explain why afterwards.
It is not impossible to protect our kids at school. They act like it is. Nancy Pelosi, well, she's got protection when she's in D.C. Apparently, her house doesn't have a lot of protection. But
so again, that is exactly what this broadcast played Monday night. Now, Carrie Lake is saying that what you just heard was the result of what she called, quote, creative editing. CNN's resident fact checker, Daniel Dale, joins us now. So what else is Carrie Lake saying about her comments on Monday?
She is claiming to reporters now that she never made light of the attack on Mr. Pelosi, and that the idea that she did or that she said anything bad was solely the result of a despicable, deceptive editing hit job by what she calls the fake news media. Listen to her comments.
I never made light on the attack. I was talking about our children and why they don't have better security at school. And I said that our politicians have security and that our athletes have security, and we need to have security for our children. Go back and look at the tape and don't do any creative editing like the fake media tends to do, and you'll see what I was saying. Despicable. Go back and look at the video. A lot of creative editing was done, okay? And I think you all know it if you were there. They clipped that clip and made it look bad. And listen, I didn't attack anybody. I want to provide security for our children at schools.
Wow, she's just flat out lying.
Yeah. Yeah, Anderson, the truth, I went back and watched that full video she insists we watch. It changes absolutely nothing. We'll show you that clip in a moment. What happens is she's asked a question about school security. She invokes the attack on Mr. Pelosi unprompted. Much of the audience laughs. The moderator chuckles so much that he's covering his face with his notes. At no point does she say, hey, this is not a joke. I'm being serious here, or it's inappropriate to laugh. Just watch the clip.
It is not impossible to protect our kids at school. They act like it is. Nancy Pelosi, well, she's got protection when she's in D.C. Apparently her house doesn't have a lot of protection. But if our lawmakers have protection, if our lawmakers can have protection, if our politicians can have protection, if our athletes, then certainly the most important people in our lives, our children, should have protection.
Unfortunately, Anderson, this is a playbook we've heard a lot in the last few years. You make a comment that might excite parts of the Republican base, and then when that comment gets you in trouble with some other people, you just claim you never did it at all.
I get her doing this. I mean, this is her shtick. Who's the guy interviewing her who covers his face like this is actually something funny? I mean, when did, like, human beings just become... When did we become like this? Who's guffawing in the audience as if it's actually funny? I mean, I don't understand. Like, there's just nothing funny about anybody being hurt. It's. I mean, I know I'm just rambling, but I'm shocked. I guess I don't know why I'm shocked, but I'm not shocked by her because, I mean, she's been faking stuff for a long time, but just the reaction of these people, like, Daniel, I'm sorry, I'm rambling. Thanks very much. I appreciate it. Just ahead, newly released emails that demonstrate just how worried one of the former president's top lawyers was about him making knowingly false claims in court about voter fraud. Details on that next. We just learned that a top former advisor to the president has been ordered to testify. Newly released emails indicate that a top campaign lawyer for the former president, a man Liz Cheney says was one of the primary architects behind efforts to overturn the election, was concerned the former president could be prosecuted for false claims in court about voter fraud. The emails were written by attorney John Eastman in December of 2020 and were among those released by a federal judge in California today. Senator Murray joined us now with details. So, sir, first of all, there's breaking news now about an advisor to the former president. What is it?
Yeah, so this is Kash Patel. He's an aide to former President Trump, and he has now been ordered by a judge to testify before the grand jury in the Mar-a-Lago documents investigation. He's been given immunity in exchange for this testimony. Look, this is significant because this is someone who has been out there claiming that the former president declassified the documents. He also was sort of intimately involved in the documents at Mar-a-Lago. So this gives prosecutors an opportunity to get information from him, to ask him, you know, whether Trump actually did declassify the documents when he, you know, is under oath without him, you know, facing potential legal ramifications. So in some ways, it's a win for prosecutors. They get his testimony, but he also gets immunity when he appears before the grand jury.
Do we know when he will appear before the grand jury?
We do not know yet when he's going to be appearing.
And what more can you tell us about what was in these Eastman emails?
Sure. So these are emails from John Eastman, a former lawyer for former President Trump, that have now been handed over to the January 6th Select Committee. And in these emails, you really get a sense of how uneasy lawyers are around the former president about some of the false election fraud claims they're putting forward. You know, there's an exchange in these emails where they're talking about how they now know some of the claims they were making about, you know, felons who voted, dead people who voted, stuff that was inaccurate. They realize lies it's inaccurate. They say that they've briefed Trump on how it's inaccurate. And they're really worried he's going to sign onto a statement that is then submitted in court and then could subject him to legal jeopardy. Here's what Eastman says in one of the emails. I have no doubt that an aggressive DA or U.S. attorney someplace would go after both the president and his lawyers once all the dust settles on this. And just to give you an idea of sort of how chaotic this was, it was December 31st, and they're trying to figure out a different way to get a notary to sort of change this document, maybe get someone over Zoom so that Trump doesn't have to sign a document saying under the penalty of perjury.
What about the emails mentioning Justice Clarence Thomas?
So part of their plan was that they wanted to be able to get a case in front of Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, and that they were hoping that he would be able to intervene. He may be able to issue some kind of tentative order that suggested that, you know, votes in Georgia were not valid because of election fraud. At one point, they say their only hope is to get something like this in front of Clarence Thomas to get him to issue an order like this. And then their belief was if something like this was pending before the Supreme Court, you couldn't certify the election on January 6th.
Is there anything in the emails about why they're so confident in Justice Thomas?
You know, it is very clear that this is where they put their confidence. It's not entirely clear why they felt like this was the person to put all their eggs in that basket.
Sarah Murray, appreciate it. Thank you. Next, NATO's former Supreme Allied Commander, retired Army General Wesley Clark, joins us on the latest signals that Russia is sending, what Western intelligence is learning about Moscow's thoughts on and discussions about the possible use of nuclear weapons in Ukraine. Disturbing details in a new U.S. intelligence assessment suggesting that Russian military officials have discussed how and under what conditions Russia would use tactical nuclear weapons on the battlefield in Ukraine. That is according to multiple sources who read the assessment. However, officials say they do not believe Vladimir Putin was involved in the discussions and have seen no signs he's decided to take the drastic step of going nuclear. At the same time, Russia's foreign ministry today issued a statement outlining when such weapons might be used, namely in response to aggression using weapons of mass destruction or conventional weapons when the existence of the Russian state is in jeopardy. Joining us, retired Army General Wesley Clark, former NATO Supreme Allied Commander and currently a CNN military analyst. So, General Clark, CNN's reporting indicating that there are mixed reactions to this new intelligence within the Biden administration, some officials concerned, saying these conversations reflect intensifying frustration in the Russian military that could raise a nuclear risk. Others believe the conversations may have been taken out of context. I'm wondering what your reaction is.
Well, my reaction is this is useful intelligence that the military is talking about it, and that would indicate that the weapons might not be used just for political effect, so it might not be just a demonstration strike in the ocean or something like this, but they might actually be used to achieve a battlefield impact.
Both Vladimir Putin and the Russian Foreign Ministry have made recent statements indicating the use of nuclear weapons in Ukraine is not necessary and does not fall under Russia's doctrine for nuclear use. Obviously, it comes after months of veiled threats from Putin on the use of these weapons. I mean, what do you believe is Russia's goal with these kind of conflicting messages?
I think the goal with the conflicting messages is to confuse and distract. Remember that before the 24th of February, Mr. Putin and his foreign minister said they weren't going to invade Ukraine. Mm. And so they say a lot of things that aren't true. Now, this is this plus the other information about the dirty bomb, the blowing up, so forth, the evacuation of civilians from Kherson. It adds up to significant concern for us.
I mean, why would Russia use a nuclear device? I mean, what military effect would it have? What would be the benefit for Russia?
Well, I'm not sure they would use a nuclear device unless they were going to go after a specific, like, road junction or factory or energy plant. But if they're going after military forces, no, you wouldn't use a single nuclear device. You'd use multiple devices, a dozen, two dozen. And you'd wait for the Ukrainians to concentrate their forces, and then you'd fire a pulse of these weapons out across several miles. And that way you'd try to achieve a real battlefield effect. One is a warning. It's a political significance. 20, 30 weapons, that could do serious damage to Ukrainian forces, let's say, if they were massing to make an attack.
But if they're massing near Russian forces, would that not also have the possibility of hurting Russian forces as well?
Sure, but if you gave the Russian forces warning, if they were dug in defensive positions behind concrete, deep in the ground, if you target the weapons successfully against Ukrainian forces, you could, might be able to minimize that effect on the Russian forces. On the other hand, the Russians might be willing to risk those forces to achieve a dominant battlefield effect and impact from these nuclear weapon strikes.
Do you think this is, I mean, in the realm of, how do you, I mean, what is the danger of this, do you think? Like the chances?
I think it's a possibility. I think we'll get some warning of this. And then when we get the warning, we've got to step up again the efforts to persuade the Russians not to do it. But the claiming of these four regions as part of Russia, that would fit Russian doctrine if the Ukrainians were coming in there to seize that territory and if they were successful or about to be successful in doing so.
General Wesley Clark, I appreciate it. Thank you. We'll be right back. That's it for us. News continues. Let's hand it over to Jake Tapper and CNN Tonight.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country, Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.